Our hearings will continue today, the 10th of August, 2022. I want to welcome all members present here at M46, members on the virtual platform. I want to welcome the public protector on the virtual platform, as well as the legal team of the public protector led by Advocate Mbofu, also on the virtual platform. Let me also welcome evidence leaders, Advocates Bauer and Mayosi, here at M46 as usual. Welcome the media. And last but not least, to welcome those who watch us, the most important role players who will be with us through 408 and YouTube, as you have always been with us. Welcome back to our inquiry sessions. The witness we have today will be with us here physically, and I will leave the introduction of the witness to Advocates Bauer and Mayosi. Just to indicate that we will start with Advocates Bauer to give us a bit of a background before we go to Ms. Fatima Ibrahim to do the preliminaries of introducing the witness to us. Advocate Bauer.
Good morning, Jay. Good morning, members. Good morning, everybody. You will...
Just maybe before you proceed, so that we know we are connected. Advocate Mpofu, can you hear us?
Yes, good morning, Chaplain. Good morning, Honorable Members and everyone else. Thank you. Yes, we can hear you clearly, Honorable Chair.
We can also hear you. Thank you very much. Thank you, Advocate Bauer.
Our witness today takes us back to the subject matter of the CX report. And because there are a number of judgments which deal with a number of matters in the motion, before we had led the first witness dealing with the CX related matter, we had taken you through the judgments of Murphy J with reference to the remedial action relating to the amendment of the Constitution. And what I want to do this morning briefly, and I say this not because the witness is necessarily going to be referring to anything in the judgment, but to remind you of the CX matter, I'm going to take you through briefly the full bench decision and what that court had found in relation to the matter. At some point in the proceedings, I will then take you through the Constitutional Court judgment, which then follows on this, which I won't necessarily deal with today, because I don't want us to be dealing with all the judgments on top of each other. It's going to get very confusing for me to do so. And I say this in a caution, because when we deal with the Constitutional Court judgments, I will point out where the Constitutional Court in any way differs with the judgment in relation thereto. So it starts off with a report 8 of 2017-18. And what then happens is the South African Reserve Bank, which I'll call SARB, the Minister of Finance and Treasury, as well as ABSA, respectively institute separate review proceedings seeking to set aside and challenges the report. So in all three applications, the relief sought is similar. They're looking to set aside the remedial action. And in fact, the Minister of Finance goes further, and he also includes the conclusions and findings referred to in the report. Now, One must bear in mind that what was before the court was not the decision of the public protector to investigate the matter, but the conclusions, findings, and the remedial action consequence upon her investigation. And the court concluded that should all the review applications succeed in reviewing and setting aside the remedial action, then it wasn't necessary to set aside the remaining parts of the report, because once the remedial action was set aside, the report had no force. Remember, it's the remedial action that is binding and that has to be implemented. And so indeed, the court had found the remedial action to be unlawful, and the court also concluded that there was a reasonable apprehension of bias. Now, the context of the case, and in a nutshell, there was a complaint submitted by Advocate Hoffman. The public protector had invoked her powers under the Public Protector Act to investigate the lifeboat transactions the Reserve Bank concluded with Bancorp/ABSA and other entities. In December 2016, the public protector released a preliminary report for comment. Right? Now, that preliminary report is also called a provisional report. The public protector made findings and conclusions which included, inter alia, that the loan provided by the Reserve Bank to Bancorp was not repaid by Absa Bank, that Absa Bank had made provisions in respect of the lifeboat given to Bancorp by the Reserve Bank, and that the government and the Reserve Bank had improperly failed to recover the amount of 3.2 billion from Absa Bank. The remedial action proposed by the public protector in a preliminary report included the following: that Treasury and the Reserve Bank must recover the money owed from Absa, being an alleged amount of 1.125 billion, which constituted 16% allegedly not paid by Absa Bank. The Treasury and the Reserve Bank must put in place systems, regulations, and policies to prevent this anomaly in providing houseboat, a lifeboat, or loans to banks in future. And that both Absa and the Reserve, so when the preliminary report had come out, both Absa and the Reserve Bank had received notices thereof, as did the President's office. And both Absa and the Reserve Bank responded to the Public Protector's preliminary report. And subsequent to that, 6 months later, on 19th June, the public protector issued a final report with findings and conclusions. And they took issue with this report because the relief or the remedies therein was materially different to what had been detailed in the preliminary report. And the public protector had made certain factual findings and came to certain conclusions in the report that included that the South African government had improperly failed to implement the CX report, which dealt with alleged stolen state funds, after commissioning the report from CX and paying for it, that the government and the Reserve Bank had improperly failed to recover 3.2 billion from Bancorp Absa, and that the South African public was prejudiced by the conduct of the South African government and the Reserve Bank. And this is what led to the finding, certain remedial findings in the report. Now, the three applications was heard as one before a full court, right? And at the time, the applicants were challenging certain remedial actions. These included, and I'll briefly say what they were, that the public protector referred the matter to the special investigating unit in terms of provisions of the Public Protector Act, and the SIU had to approach the president to reopen and amend the proclamation in order to recover the misappropriated public funds, and for the SIU to investigate the alleged misappropriated public funds given to various institutions as mentioned in the CX report. And the Reserve Bank was directed to cooperate fully with the SIU and to assist the SIU in the recovery of these funds. Further, that the SIU, the Reserve Bank, and the Chair of the Portfolio Committee on Justice and Correctional Services had to submit an action plan to the Public Protector within 60 days of the steps taken in the remedial action. Mm-hmm. Now, because it was a review application, a Rule 53 record had to be filed, and that is effectively all the documentation to which regard was had for purposes of compiling the report. And as a bone of contention of what arose was two sets of interviews One had been conducted with officials of the SSA and the other with the presidency. Right. So what the court noted was that it appeared from this report prior to its finalizing, from the report that prior to finalizing the final report, the public protector had interviews with officials from the SSA and a certain Stefan Mitford Goodson. Further, that she did not disclose that she had also met with officials from the presidency and representatives of an organization known as Black First Land First. Right. The court noted that the remedial action was totally different in the final report as to the preliminary report, and the complaint was that the applicants had not been afforded an opportunity to comment on the conclusions reached in the report and the intended remedial action. So the public protector raised 2 points in limine before the full bench. One, that the applicant's rights had not been materially affected by a remedial action, and two, the legal question of an unreasonable delay in having challenged the public protector. The court dismissed both. Right? Now, the applicants, or the first and second applicant, had brought the application both in terms of the Promotion of Administrative Justice Act and in the alternative in terms of Section 1C of the Constitution, or what we know as the principle of legality. And it's not uncommon for applications to be brought where it's drafted either in terms of PAJA or under legality. And the full bench, in the course of its judgment, concludes that the decision and the remedial action set out in the report is administrative action, but then also says that to the extent we may have misdirected ourselves and it's not administrative action, then the principle of legality applies. Right. Further in the relief being sought was that the Reserve Bank had asked the full bench for a declarator, for the court to declare that the public protector had abused the office. And this relief was dismissed and refused by the High Court. And I'm not going to deal with the in limine points in detail, but I want to deal with a section which comes under the heading of procedural unfairness in the judgment. Because both SARB, the Reserve Bank, and APSA contended that the public protector had failed to conduct a fair and unbiased investigation, giving rise to a ground of review of a reasonable apprehension of bias. And this was because the public protector had meetings with the SSA and the presidency after the publication of the provisional report and had not afforded the reviewing parties a similar opportunity. And they then contended that these meetings occurred was not proper and could not have been conducted correctly during the course of the investigation. And there was reference to a note which we had heard evidence on from Mr. Kikani dated the 3rd of May 2017, which was included in the record. And it was alleged that the discussion of the topics of the Reserve Bank and the question of how are they vulnerable, well, the SSA indicated that the public protector's investigation was aimed at undermining the Reserve Bank. That was the allegation put in the affidavits. The court then said the question was not posed to the experts at the Reserve Bank, who is ultimately qualified to answer the question, and that the public protector should have consulted with him. In the supplementing founding paper, APSA took a similar line in relation to what the Reserve Bank had taken, indicating that they had also not been so alerted. The issue then also arose, raised by APSA, of the reference in the note to the discussion of the remedial action, including that the operations of the Reserve Bank be aligned to social responsibility, and a discussion of what appears to be options for recovery of the money supposedly owing by APSA, including the payment thereof in installments, or that the state should be given APSA shares as a form of repayment. And the judgment then records that APSA was disturbed as to why the SSA should have any views on the remedial action being considered by the public protector against APSA, having failed to alert APSA of the meeting or giving them an opportunity to an Audi in respect of the relief. The public protector pointed out in her report that she had made certain findings concerning the government and the South African Reserve Bank's failure to recover the funds and direct them to take remedial action. Therefore, because she had done that, both the president as the primary representative of government and the SIU were implicated as contemplated in Section 79 of the PP Act. In other words, by virtue of them being implicated, she afforded them an opportunity to respond. The president had responded on the 28th of February 2017, and the presidency had sought a meeting to take place on 25 April 2017. When I come to the Constitutional Court judgments, there is a correction of an error, which I won't correct at this stage, and I'm saying so so that Advocate Mpofu is alerted that I will deal with it in the Concord judgment when the error is corrected. But what was before the full bench is raised that during the meeting, the public protector became concerned that her draft remedial action to direct the president to establish a judicial commission may face similar difficulties that was being faced in what was then a challenge to the state capture report. And accordingly, that was then amended in the report to reflect a recommendation in respect of the SIU. Further, that the agreement that was the subject matter of the investigation was an agreement between CX and the government, and it was then signed by the then Director General of the South African National Intelligence Agency, the predecessor to the SSA. And so according to the public protector, it was necessary to have a follow-up meeting with this entity to confirm the agreement and to inquire why the SSA failed to follow up the matter on its implementation. Right? So the fact that these meetings took place wasn't really in dispute before the court. What was an issue and wasn't also in dispute that neither APSA nor the Reserve Bank had known about these meetings or that they had similar meetings. It also wasn't in dispute that the public protector had not attached transcripts of those meetings. So what the court then said was that the context in which this had to be considered was the public protector's report, and that the public protector had disclosed under the heading correspondence sent and received that there was correspondence between her and the presidency. And under the heading interviews conducted and meetings held, that there was a list of meetings held with various persons, including the meeting with the SSI on 3 May 2017. The court then said it was, however, important to point out that there was no reference to any meeting with the presidency in the report. It was only in her answering affidavit that she admitted to a meeting with the presidency on 25 April 2017, but that she was silent on the second meeting, which took place on 7 June 2017. And that the only way the reviewing parties had become aware of this meeting was because of a handwritten note that had been included in the Rule 53 record. In addition to this, that during the meeting which she had with the SSA, the issue of the vulnerability had arisen. And this they had become aware of with regard to the Rule 53 record. So the court concluded that the public protector had not given the same opportunity to consult to the reviewing parties or to allow them the opportunity to respond to the adverse findings that directly implicated the Reserve Bank and APSA in the report. And that it was indeed so that the findings so implicated them. Right? And the court then said, if it was an oversight not to have afforded the Reserve Bank and APSA a further hearing, then they would have expected the public protector to have said so in an answering affidavit. Taking all of this into account, they said, having regard to all of these considerations, we are of the view that a reasonable, objective, and informed person, taking into account all these facts, would reasonably have an apprehension that the public protector would not have brought an impartial mind to bear on the issues before, and then concluded that there was a reasonable suspicion of bias. So the court had regard to the following in addition thereto. That the public protector had relied on new reasons in her answering affidavit, which did not accord with the reasons she set out in her report. She justified her findings ex post facto in the answering affidavit. She attached documents that were not filed and were not included in the record of proceedings filed in terms of Rule 53. And her averment that she had received advice from economic experts while compiling the report was doubtful. Dr. Mokoka's report was only obtained following receipt of the review applications. So the court reiterated the position that the public protector had a heightened obligation to be frank and candid when dealing with the court. They concluded that the public protector had two meetings with the presidency after the release of the preliminary report, but failed to address the second meeting and failed to disclose what was discussed. Secondly, that the meeting with the SSA and the former Minister of State Security on 3 May 2017 and the discussions pertaining to the Reserve Bank could not be justified in any manner. Thirdly, that she had engaged directly, that she should have engaged directly with the Reserve Bank if she was concerned about the security of the Reserve Bank. And further, that she had failed to record these meetings, although it was customary to record all meetings. So the court concluded that that the public protector did not conduct herself in a manner that should be expected from a person occupying the office of the public protector. Even so, it didn't make a finding or declaratory order that the public protector had abused the office, and she didn't do so because that relief had only been sought in reply and it wasn't procedurally before the court. That relief had been opposed by the public protector because as an inappropriate attack on the public protector and as relief that sought to undermine the office, the institution of the public protector. Counsel for the public protector had argued that it had not been proven on the papers that the public protector had acted in bad faith. She had no malice or sinister purpose when meeting with the presidency and the SSA without alerting APSA and the Reserve Bank that she had done so. And the question remained unanswered, the court said, as to why she had acted in such a secretive manner, and she did not give an explanation to do so. It then said that it's possible that the public protector had not taken fully the court into its confidence when deposing to the answering affidavit, when she set out, when I make averments relating to economics, I do so on the basis of advice received from economic experts during the investigation of the complaint referred to below, which advice I accept as correct. Dr. Mokoko's report, the court held, was obtained after the final report had been issued. It was against this factual background that the judgment took these factors into account when it came to the issue of costs. And it concluded that the public protector did not fully understand a constitutional duty to be impartial and to perform her functions without fear, favor, or prejudice, and that she had failed to disclose in the report that she had a meeting with the presidency on the two dates referred to. Further, that she had failed to make a full disclosure in her answering affidavit when she was saying that she was acting on advice received with regarding to averments relating to economics prior to a report. We had already pointed out that Dr. Mokoko's report was obtained afterwards. And thirdly, it was in light of this that the court considered a punitive cost order and had went further than simply a punitive cost order and in fact ordered that the public protector should pay 15% of the cost of the Reserve Bank and the office should pay 85% of the cost on an attorney-client scale. The PP sought, the public protector sought leave to appeal to the full bench of the SCA. That application was dismissed. Direct access, alternatively, leave to appeal directly to the Constitutional Court was sought. And that leave was then granted, and they argued before the Constitutional Court. Now, there were further affidavits filed before the Constitutional Court that warrants a separate explanation and would put some of what was not said before the High Court into a different context. And when we deal with this again, I will deal with the Constitutional Court judge. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Advocate Bauer. I now recognize Ms. Fatima Ibrahim.
Good morning. Thank you, Chair. Advocate Chira Lula, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you, ma'am.
Good morning. Advocate Chira Lula, you have been invited subject to the provisions of Section 16 of the Powers, Privileges and Immunity of Parliament and Provincial.
So just a pause, Ms. Ibrahim. We're just fixing so that he keeps his mic on and closer to you, possibly. So yours will stay on. So
recording in progress.
Thank you. Start again, Ms. Ibrahim.
Thank you. You have been invited subject to the provisions of Section 16 of the Powers, Privileges and Immunities of Parliament and Provincial Legislatures Act 2004 to appear before this committee as a witness and to answer questions in respect of the committee's inquiry into the removal of the public protector, Advocate Mkwebane. Please be informed that by law, you are required to answer fully and satisfactorily all the questions lawfully put to you or to produce any document that you are required to produce in connection with the subject matter of this inquiry, notwithstanding the fact that the answer or the document could incriminate you or expose you to criminal or civil proceedings or damages. You are, however, protected in that evidence given under oath or affirmation before a House or committee may not be used against you in any court or place outside of Parliament, except in criminal proceedings concerning a charge of perjury or a charge relating to the evidence or documents required in these proceedings. Please be aware further that in terms of Section 17(2) of the Powers Act, a person who willfully furnishes a House or committee with information or makes a statement before it which is false or misleading, commits an offence and is liable to a fine or imprisonment for a period not exceeding 2 years. Advocate Chira Lula, I will now require you to either take an oath or affirmation that the evidence you are about to give is truthful. Which do you prefer?
I'll take an oath.
May I please ask that you raise your right hand and repeat after me? I swear that the evidence I shall give.
I swear that the evidence I shall give.
Shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
Will be the truth and the whole truth, but nothing, the truth.
But truth, so help me God.
So help me God.
Thank you, Mr. Chira Lula. Chair, the witness is now duly sworn in.
Thank you, Ms. Ibrahim, and thank you, Advocate Chira Lula. You nearly tripped there in the whole truth and nothing but the truth, and it kind of turned around. Hopefully it won't affect what we're dealing with. So please relax and just stay focused. Thank you very much. I now recognize Advocate Mayosim, and to indicate that I am allocating you a certain amount of time. You don't have to use it when there's no need. Between now and lunchtime, you can finish at any time before that. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning, Advocate Chira Lula. Good morning, members. And good morning, members of the public. Earlier this morning, we had word from Advocate Mbofu's camp that there are certain aspects of the affidavit of Advocate Chira Lula that are common cause, that are not in dispute. I will nevertheless take you through those aspects that are not in dispute just for context for the committee. Paragraphs 1 to 27 of the affidavit, they indicated are not in dispute. But as I say, just for context, I'll take you through those and I'll lead you through those quite quickly so that we get through those items. So Advocate Chira Lula, you state you're an admitted advocate, right?
Correct.
But you're not currently practicing as one.
Correct.
So you joined the PPSA in about 2014, correct?
Correct.
And when you joined the PPSA, the CIX investigation, it was pretty much already started, correct?
Correct.
Would you say it was already in a substantial stage?
Yes, it was already in a substantial stage.
Yeah. Can you tell the committee at what stage it was, what interviews had occurred? Okay. What interviews had you been part of? Had you not been part of?
Okay. So when I when we started with the investigation, or when I joined the investigation, there had been a number of interviews that were already done with a number of people. The one that I can recall is that there was an interview that had already been done with former Reserve Bank Governor Tito Mboweni. There was also an interview that had already been done with former Reserve Bank Governor, I think as Gil Marcus. There was also an interview that had already been done with the complainant at the time had already been engaged. There was also an interview that had already been done with the author of the CX report, which is Michael Otley. Those are the ones that I can recall now. And then the interviews that we did with Advocate Madonsela, we interviewed former Finance Minister, I think Trevor Manuel. We interviewed the former CEO of APSA, Maria Ramos. We interviewed the former Reserve Bank Governor, Dr. Chris Dawes. We interviewed former Director General in the Presidency, I think it was Frank Chikane. We interviewed former President Mbeki. We also had an engagement with other officials within the Reserve Bank who were obviously assisting with the investigation as well. Those are the people that I can recall that we did interview during the period that I was working on the investigation.
Okay. So we skipped a bit there. But when you joined in 2014, you joined as a trainee investigator, is that right?
Yeah. Yes, then quickly after that, I was then appointed as an assistant investigator. Later on, I was then appointed as an investigator.
And you worked with who?
I worked with, previously I was working with advocate, the former deputy public protector, Advocate Malunga. In the private office, then later on, then I then directly worked with Advocate Madonsela.
And you say in your affidavit that you were involved in quite in some of the big investigations that were happening at the time, right?
Yes. Yeah, I was a part of the number of investigations that were taking place in the office of the Power Protector, simply because whenever the PP would go either to a province or a particular unit where investigation has been conducted, I would then be the person that obviously go in, then assist her. And the same would happen with the Deputy Power Protector. So I was part of the CX investigation. I was also part of the state capture investigation when it began the time.
Right. So in paragraphs 8 and 9 of your affidavit, you set out the process of drafting and producing an investigation report. And you talk about quality assurance until the report is finally done. So at the time when you were in the private office, after Advocate Mkhwebane arrived, the think tank and the quality assurance function happened concurrently? They were still existing at the same time?
Correct.
Okay, and what would happen then? Can you just briefly just detail for the committee?
Okay.
That process of producing a report.
All right, thank you. So ordinarily, the report would be drafted by an investigator from a particular unit or a particular province. That report would then send to the quality assurance team. The quality assurance team will then be responsible to table the report at the think tank meeting. The think tank meeting comprises of the heads of provinces, or what the Power Protector's Office would call provincial reps, and all the senior managers and executive managers in the Office of Power Protector, chaired by the Power Protector. We would also play a role of being the secretariat. And when I say we, I mean the team that was obviously assisting the PP together with the quality assurance team will then put together that the purpose of the think tank when I was there was mainly to obviously look at the quality of the reports. This would be the to check if all the processes have been followed in line with the standard operational processes that were established at the time when I was there. So it would have to look at the facts on the report, look at the whether the laws have been applied properly, case laws that probably would have been considered in the report, whether they have been applied properly, the language of the report, the tone. It also had a role to play in as far as suggesting names of the reports. You'd recall that at the time, Advocate Matonzela would have catchy titles of the report. So that committee will then be responsible to say, well, in this particular report, we think that to assist the reader of the report, this will be a catchy name that will then obviously inform the reader before they even go into the details of the report, what the report will talk about. I mean, for example, we'll talk about Derailed, which was a PRASA report. That name came from the whole process that took place through the think tank. There were also suggestions that I can talk about, which I find interesting at the time, which obviously some of it you might not obviously know about because it was happening internally. There was a report that we were working on before I left, or a Section 7-9, where we had already started to suggest names about how we should name the report. The Mandela funeral one, I think it's the Eastern Cape investigation, where I had already started suggesting names like Not In My Name, or I Didn't Die For This. Those were the names which I thought that report would invoke the spirit of Madiba in a way that people would have looted resources under, you know, his name, where they were saying to bury him, this is what we are going to be doing. So there were those kind of catchy names that we had at the time at the think tank, where there would be ideas that come from different people from around the country who are senior officials within the Office of the Public Protector.
Okay. And you say in paragraph 9 that the last say on any report rests with the PP. By this you mean the PP, whoever it is finally accountable for the contents of a report, correct?
Correct.
Okay. And then in paragraphs 10, you begin to talk about the CIX report, and that on the 13th of October, you then emailed a copy of that report to Advocate Matonzela, right?
Correct.
But there was further work that still needed to be done on it. Can you just tell the committee what further work still needed to be done on that draft?
Okay. We had interviewed Dr. Stiles, the former Reserve Bank governor, I think somewhere around September, if I'm not mistaken. And he had given us so much information. Part of that information was that we were actually not in the right track in terms of our argument that there were no monies that were repaid. And he then indicated to us that he's actually going to prove to us that in terms of the loan, APSA did pay that particular loan, and he proved to us. So that information came, was submitted to us somewhere late September. I felt that we didn't have enough time to go through that whole evidence that was provided to us to obviously be able to say to the Power Protector or the former Power Protector, this report could go through and be signed. There were also issues that we needed to do relating to research and case law, which had not been done at that particular time. So those were the issues.
Okay. And you do say that Advocate Matonzela then responded to you. She responded to you by way of a covering email where she, you had said to her that there were some interviews that you had not attended, and you required some input from her relating to the inputs from those interviews. She then responded and she told you what had happened in those interviews. And she also, you say in your affidavit, she also gave you a hard copy version with some handwritten notes. What happened to the version with Advocate Matonzela's handwritten notes?
Okay. I incorporated the changes that were on the hand, on the document that she had written on in the draft report.
Yeah,
that's what I did. I
in the handwritten notes.
Yes, in the handwritten notes. Yeah.
Will you go to LT3, page 3217, Sepo?
Yeah.
So that was Advocate Matansela's response, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So she then responded, interview parties. These are the interviews that she had attended that you had not attended, right?
Yes, I was not party to this.
Right. Interview. Did you incorporate these changes into the report?
Yes, I did.
Okay.
I did. I think those appear in my, they appear on page 3365.
The Billy Masetla changes appear on 3365, right?
Yes, yes.
And the Praveen Gordhan changes appear on 3364. Page 3664, right?
Yes.
The Bertelsmann changes appear on page 3359.
Yes.
Of the record, the Oatley changes on 3359 as well.
Yes.
The Michael Durr changes on 3359 and so on, correct?
Correct.
All right. And then on the same, and then later on the same day, there was a letter from Chris Moraitis of Worksmen's. Will you just tell the committee what that was about?
Yes, so we received a letter from the attorneys that were representing APSA at the time, sorry, Reserve Bank at the time, and they were inquiring about the release of the provisional report by the power protector. And this was because the 14th, I think it was the last day that the PP was in the office, and obviously they needed to understand whether the report was going to be released and whether they'll be afforded an opportunity to then comment on that. So that was the reason why we got that particular correspondence.
Right. But you say that after that, you were then requested by the PP's PA. The PP was requesting a briefing from you regarding the reports that were finalized by her predecessor that had not yet been released. Did this briefing occur? And can you just tell the committee what happened at that briefing, if it did occur?
Yes. So what happened is that soon after the PP was appointed, I got a call from the PA saying I have to brief the power protector. This was because at the time when the former PP left, we had a memory stick in the private office that kept all the reports that were supposed to have been released. This includes Section 79 letters that were supposed to have been released. And the former PP had already indicated to me that when the new PP comes through, she will obviously have a handover with her. But there are documents that we need to hand over to her, which she did not manage to release when she was still in the office at that particular time. The briefing did happen. I did brief her. And I indicated to her that the report had not been finalized. There were also changes that were already made by Advocate Matonzela, which I had already obviously inserted on the report. I went to her office. I met with her. I downloaded the reports or gave her the reports that were on the memory stick so that she can have sight of those. It was during this period that she then indicated to me that there was a pressure from society. And this pressure, I think, she then indicated that there was pressure from society at the time regarding this particular report. I understood this pressure to mean that before Advocate Matonzela left the office, I think a month or so before she left the office, there were a number of organizations that were camping at the office outside. We had also complainants who were, some of them threatening to sleep in the office at the time because they are reports had not yet been finalized, and Advocate Matonzela, now that she's leaving, they might not see the light, those reports and everything. And there was an organization called Black First Land First, if I'm not mistaken, I might not be pronouncing it properly there. That organization had a very keen interest on this investigation. And she did mention that they'd already reached out to her about this particular investigation. I explained to her at the time that obviously there were changes that I had not yet finalized in setting. I finalized them and that I was providing that report to her following the changes that were already suggested by the former PP. I handed over the report to her in that regard.
Okay. So you handed the report to her together with the changes that had been suggested by Advocate Madonsela incorporated into that draft.
Correct.
All right. And then you carry on in your affidavit and you say you had another discussion with her in November. So you had a number of meetings with the PP discussing the report?
Yes, correct.
Okay. Can you just tell the committee if, and you do allude to this in your affidavit, if at any point during these discussions you handed over documentation to the PP relating to the investigation?
So after I had handed over the draft report to the PP, she requested that I should also hand over the evidence. I went to her office and handed over the boxes, the two boxes of evidence that we had at that particular time. And I asked her whether she still needed or required more time, you know, because I was seeing that she had been with the report for a while, and I asked and she indicated that she still needed to go through the report. She will advise once she's done. I recall handing over the evidence to her at that particular time, the two boxes, the evidence. I sent the information that was in the boxes to her. If I recall well, it included transcribed interviews of the meetings that we had with the officials that were interviewed. It also included some of the documents that were submitted to us by some of the people that we'd interviewed at the time.
Yeah, so you handed over. Yes. Are you able to recall now the specifics of the documentation you handed over to her?
Yeah, the ones that I can recall right now are the transcribed interviews for all the individuals, or some of the individuals that I know we had already done the transcribe of their interviews. There were several correspondences that were sent by Michael Otley at the time, where he was inquiring why the government was no longer proceeding with him and in the investigation that he had done, because he had already given them a prelim report, and he thought that they would continue with the agreement for him to finalize the investigation in other things that he had already raised with them. So those were some of the documents that formed part of the information or in the box that I handed over to the PP at that time.
Okay. Yeah. And then on the 25th of November, you got alternative employment with your current employer, and you told the PP about this, right?
Yes.
And she, of course, naturally was concerned about you dealing with all the reports that you had under your control and handing those over properly. Is that right?
Correct.
Right. And then can you tell the committee about the request you received from her on the 7th of December to do some further research on other countries' reserve banks?
Okay, thanks for that question. I received an email from the PP requesting me to do further research on other countries' reserve bank and some obviously indication on how they are controlled or whether the state has any control over those. I did that research. I looked at number of central banks around the world. I checked the US one. I did look at China. In the African continent, I did look at Nigeria, simply because I considered it to be a leading, you know, economy in the African continent as well. I also looked at the Russia one and also Zimbabwe. Those were the ones that I did look at. I didn't understand this. I must obviously clearly indicate I didn't understand this because there was no link between the complaint that came from Paul Hoffman and or Mr. Advocate Paul Hoffman and this request. And one had to comply, obviously, just to say we will look at this. But I didn't understand where we were going with this, because the issue from the complaint had nothing to do with what obviously was what she was asking Nonetheless, I obviously proceeded to do this research and look at how other central banks around the world deal with the issue of obviously control in as far as whether they are nationalized or state-owned or they are privately owned in that regard.
Okay. And then you say on the 20th, you emailed the finalized report to her chief of staff, Ms. Linda Mulelekwa, and as well as Tebogo Kekana. What role was Tebogo Kekana playing in this at the time?
Okay. So soon after I tendered my resignation, which was in November, end of November, I was then told by the chief of staff Ms. Linda Mulelekwa, that because I'll be leaving that office and there's so much work that I was doing as far as some of the investigation in the private office are concerned, they are now going to bring in Mr. Kekana to then assist with the work that I was doing. And I must then do a proper handover to him. And that was in that regard. I understood it to be in that particular way that Mr. Kekana was then brought in.
And then what happened after you submitted the report to him and Ms. Mulelekwa?
The PP then signed the report on the 21st of December. The report was signed together with the Section 79 covering letters. These are covering letters that obviously would be together with the report directed to the implicated parties so that they are able to see what the PP's findings are likely to be and also what the proposed or the likely recommended or remedial actions would look like in that regard. So at least they have an opportunity to comment on that. So the report was then emailed to the implicated parties.
Can you remember who you sent the report and Section 79 notices to? Who were the implicated parties in your recollection?
Okay. I remember sending the report to the Office of the President, I think the presidency at that time. The report was also sent to APSA. The report was also sent to Reserve Bank. The report was also sent to the Minister of Finance. Yeah, those are the parties I can recall now.
And you sent the report and the Section 79 notices to those parties, right?
Correct.
Right. So you know who the complainant was in this whole matter, right?
Correct.
Can you just tell the committee who it was?
Okay. The complainant was Advocate Paul Hoffman from an organization called Accountability Now. That's all I can remember.
Did you send the Section 79 notices and the report to the complainant?
No, I didn't.
And why? Why did you not?
Okay. So Section 79 letters, by their very nature, they are sent to implicated people for them to comment. There was no reason from my side that I saw that the report should be sent to Mr. Paul Hoffman. The only thing that was supposed to have happened, which I think it did happen when he made an inquiry, was just to update him that the PP has now finalized the provisional report of Section 79. That has been now sent to the parties for comment. They've been given 14 days to comment. So at least he then get the progress of where the investigation is in as far as that is concerned. And that was done. I remember that was done because when I got a call late December, I think around the 28-29, I did advise the PA of the PP at that time that there was this call that I received talking about somebody not receiving the report, and this was a complaint in that particular time, and that we just need to update the complainant, not to give him the report, because there has always been an issue about leak of reports by, you know, individuals in that regard, especially those that are not implicated, if you just share the reports with them.
So it is your evidence that you did not provide the report to the complainant because they were not an implicated party in the investigation?
Yeah, correct. Right.
Okay. In your affidavit, you also deal with the issue of prescription. If we go to paragraph 34 of your affidavit,
okay.
and you explain in that section that you and Advocate Matanzela had a different view regarding the issue of prescription in the report. Can you just explain that to the committee, please?
Okay, so when we were discussing the possible remedial action that obviously had to be put in the report, I had several engagements with Advocate Matanzela about this. We obviously didn't share the same view. I was entirely convinced that the debt was recoverable. That was my position, which is a position that I advanced. She shared a view that the debt can't be recovered because it is prescribed. I decided that particular time that I'm going to give Advocate Matanzela two versions of the report. One that says this can be recovered and that... If anything, prescription should be raised by those that we are saying they should the monies should be recovered from them and not us. We should not become the ones that argue the defense of prescription, but rather the implicated party is the one who must say, well, this debt is already prescribed. Advocate Matanzela didn't share that view. That view was that we can't recover here. Because the claim is already prescribed. I prefer the version that find expression in the provisional report. That was my preference, that there is something that can be done to recover this this old amount of money.
Okay. Go to page to LT4, page 3220. Paragraph 7.1.6. Go up. Yeah. So this is an extra LT4 to your affidavit, which is the draft report that Advocate Matanzela left behind, correct?
Correct.
Yeah. So just go up, Tebo, just so we can see 7.1.6 in totality, up or down or whatever. Yeah. So is that the manner in which Advocate Matanzela preferred to deal with prescription?
Correct.
That's the report that she left behind?
Correct.
Okay, but you had a different view, as you've explained, correct?
Correct.
Okay, so I just want to juxtapose that against... the view that the current PP had in relation to prescription. So if we go to page 3373, paragraph 7.2.3. Yeah, just show us the whole thing. Yeah. Was this the view that you supported? This is how the matter was dealt with in the provisional report that was released on the 21st of December 2016.
Yeah, correct. Yeah, I supported this.
Is this the view that you supported?
Yes.
And that you discussed with the PP?
Correct.
Right.
Yeah.
Was it you who introduced this change to the draft, to the provisional report?
Yes, I'm the one who did that.
Okay.
Yeah. And I think just to qualify this or to explain this, so there was a discussion I had with the PP about the recovery issue and everything. And I was saying, the argument came in the angle of saying, what should be the amount? Because, I mean, the agreement between Reserve Bank and ABSA was that the interest must be paid within a period of 5 years. If my memory serves me well, but I think those documents should be obviously with the committee here, that particular agreement. Now, years have gone by, you know, after the 5 years had passed in terms of that whole agreement, and the interest had not yet been paid. And the argument was, how much will that be? So the argument from my side was, it is, you know, there is a common law rule that says you can't, interest can run over the capital amount for the loan. So if you are owed 500 rand, or you're owing someone 500 rand and the interest would then start to run, the interest can then be more than the particular, the loan that you have received. So it immediately, when it gets to the capital loan, it then stop running. That was the argument in that particular time. Thanks, Chair.
I apologize for interrupting, Chair. I just want to get a clarity. Which public protector did the witness make that submission to? To Advocate Mkhubane. Thank you, Chair.
So the witness's evidence is that he differed a bit with on the issue of prescription with the former PP, and he had discussions with the current PP about those two versions. And yes. So going back to your affidavit, go back to his affidavit, please, Sepa. Yes, paragraph 39. Yeah. Yeah. So when you were conducting the investigation with Advocate Madansala, did she engage the services of an economic expert at all?
No.
And then in your affidavit, you go on and you talk about the meeting with the PPSA officials. Paragraph 42. Yeah?
Paragraph is that?
Yeah, yeah. How did this come about, and why did this come about? And you can you just tell the committee about this?
Paragraph 42.
In early 2017.
Okay. So after I left the office of the public protector, the preliminary report was then leaked, and it was in the public domain, and people were talking about it. The media was writing a lot of articles about it. Advocate Mkhwebane then wrote to my new employer, requesting to meet with me to iron out a few things relating to the CX investigation. I had a meeting with the power protector in January, if not February, 2017. I was supposed to meet with the PP in person in Pretoria. When I arrived, I was then told that the PP is in Cape Town. She's appearing before the, I think, the Justice Committee. We had a virtual meeting. She was linked from the boardroom. We were in the boardroom, and then she was linked through Skype. Present with me in the meeting was senior investigator at the time, Mr. Isaac Matlau, with Mr. Kekana, who had already taken over from me, as well as the chief of staff there, Ms. Linda Mulelekwa. Those are the people who were in that particular meeting. The PP had, the connection was not quite good at the time. When she was joining the meeting, she was quite brief in that meeting, and she lost connection. we then nonetheless continue with the meeting. Then that's when I was formally informed by Mr. Kekana that he has now been appointed or formally, you know, asked to take over the investigation, and that he was not that much familiar with the things that were happening during that investigation, and that I should avail myself as and when the office require me to assist them with the investigation.
Yeah, so in your explanation in your affidavit about what happened at that meeting, you say that they obviously wanted clarity about various things. They wanted to know about the transcripts of interviews.
Yes.
Can you tell the committee about that?
Yeah, I was then asked that there were several you know, transcripts that they couldn't find, and information that they wanted, which is not in the box that I had handed over. As I've indicated, Chair, before I left the office, I had handed over everything, including my laptop and everything, all the documents that we had during that particular period when we were doing the investigation. So the number of questions that we asked to say they wanted to check where the transcribed interviews of some of the witnesses that we had interviewed during that particular time. And also there was an issue of the provisional report, why the provisional report was released as opposed to Section 7-9.
Can you explain that? There seems to have been a misunderstanding where it appears that there was a view that it shouldn't have been released in the form that it was released, but you had a different view?
Yes. I think in November, the think tank said in November, it took a decision after several leaks that were taking place in the office of the Power Protector that we are no longer going to be releasing provisional reports, but rather will then issue Section 7-9 notices to the implicated parties. In that meeting, I reminded the those who were in attendance of the resolution that was taken in that meeting and its ambit in terms of the CX report and other reports, that these report, the CX report, did not really fall within that resolution, as it was already in the private office and the PP was already finalizing it. And there were other reports that were signed within that particular period. I remember the Malanda report, which was also signed. It was an investigation that was done by, I think, Advocate Niels van der Merwe. It was a provisional report that I facilitated when it was sent to the private office for the PP's signature as well. So that's in brief what I indicated to them, to those that were in attendance of that meeting. I remember that time when I mentioned that the PP had already been cut off in that because she had a problem with the connection through Skype.
Right. So the PP herself, in fact, signed the provisional report as well as the Section 7-9 notice.
Correct.
Of the 21st of December. Did she indicate in any way to you that these were not to go out in that form?
No.
Okay.
She just indicated that I should send, and when I'm sending out those reports, I must copy Mr. Kekan. You would see in the emails that when I send out the report that Mr. Kekan is copied there. The chief of staff is copied there, and I think PA as well. So she indicated that to make sure that when they respond, because I won't be there, I'm the 31st of December was my last day. So when the responses are coming through, at least they should be able to, there should be someone who is going to be able to receive those responses from the office.
Yeah. But you also say in paragraph 45 that they were, the PPSA officials that you were meeting with on that day were also asking you about the contents of the provisional report, and you couldn't really assist them in that regard because, as you say, in your view, the contents of the provisional report were materially different to the report that was left behind by Advocate Madonsela. Is that right?
Correct.
So I'd like you to be more specific about this, please, for the assistance of the committee, these differences, which in your view you felt were there and were material. And just for the benefit of the committee members, we're going to be fleeting a little bit between the provisional report that was left by Advocate Madonsela and the draft report left by Advocate Madonsela and the provisional report released. So bear with me because we're going to be going through.
You do that through the chair so that you are able to address all the members.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Chair. I just thought that I should explain the confusion that might ensue.
Okay.
So, of course, I'm going to lead you on this because you've sort of shared what you say the material differences.
Yes.
Tsepo, if you go to page 3316, please. Right. This is the provisional report released on the 21st of December, correct?
Correct.
Can you talk about the contents of that page?
Okay. So, it reads, I think, the primary function of this Reserve Bank. If you look at the one that was the draft that the PP, the former Public Protector, left, differ with this paragraph. It completely differ with this paragraph.
Sorry, which paragraph? Paragraph X.
Yeah, X I.
X11. That's paragraph. Yeah, X11. 12. I think Roman numeral 12.
Yeah.
Is that the only difference?
There's also section 5 of the executive summary.
Of the executive summary.
Completely differs with the one that was left by Advocate Madonsela.
Go to section 5 of the executive summary, which is... It's section 5 of the executive summary, you say, is completely different. It's at page 3327, Tsepo.
No, it's 3315.
3327. Yeah, 27. Is Advocate Chiolule, is that the section 5, starting from paragraph 5 there?
Correct.
And going down, is that an entirely new section from?
Yes, it is entirely a new section.
Okay. Right. What are the changes are you able to see in the report?
Okay. On the remedial action, there is a change there that I noticed, I think, where it says National Treasury and SARB to institute legal action.
Sorry, what paragraph?
Trying to check the paragraph. Just hold for a moment.
Remedial action.
Yes, on the remedial action.
Do you have a page there?
Just a moment. So I think it's it should be on.
Look at the top of your affidavit. The page.
Yeah, I think it's 3318.
3318.
Yeah, it should be 3318.
Okay. Go to 3318. Which remedial action are you talking about?
This whole part.
Just go up.
With written National Treasury.
Oh, okay.
And presidents, I think.
No, go up. National Treasury, go up. Go up. Yes.
3318.
Yeah.
Might appear on... Yes. 3365. Might be 3365 and 3364 and then 3359. The
Okay. So let me just help you, Mr. Shivalula. In the section on page 3329, under that section, under National Treasury, do you see that?
Yes.
Under paragraph 3?
Yes.
Was it new?
Yeah, this is entirely new.
So this, your evidence is that this was new in the provisional report and it was not in Advocate Matjansela's report?
Correct.
Did you make this change? Did you add this change to the report? Paragraph 3?
Yes, I did, yeah. That was my changes. Those were my changes.
You made this change to the report?
Yes.
Let's just go through the other changes. Are there any other changes to the provisional report that was left by Advocate Matjansela that are different to the report that was issued in December?
Yes. If you check the December draft, where it talks about the evidence from Judge Bertelsmann,
yes,
Oakley, Mr. Oakley and Mr. Michael Dre,
yes,
and Trevor Manuel, you'll notice that there are changes there.
Yeah, you made those changes because Advocate Matjansela had told you to make those changes.
Correct.
Right? So if you go to page 3317. Yeah? Right. Paragraph 3317, paragraph X1X. Yeah, good. So you see that in paragraph X1X, Roman numeral X1X, it should be noted that the South African Reserve Bank disputed that it failed to recover an amount of 3.2 billion from Absa Bank. And if you go down to paragraph XX, Tsepo, South African government, led by President Mbeki at the time, also disputed that they failed to recover an amount of 3.2 billion.
Yes.
That is different to the previous draft, right?
Yes,
because in
correct.
The previous draft of Advocate Matjansela, those were in fact not disputed claims. Is that correct?
Correct.
Did you make those changes?
Nope. I didn't make those changes.
And then, of course, your testimony is that the executive summary section, section 5, is all new.
Yes.
Right. Can you go to page 3329, Zephyr? Yeah, he's already given evidence that that section 3 is new in the sense that it was not in Advocate Madansela's report. Is that right?
Correct.
Okay. Right. Paragraph 8.2.3, and that's the paragraph that your testimony is that it's new in this report.
Correct.
Okay. So then it's your evidence in your affidavit that you then told the PSS PPSA officials that some of the changes that were in the report that was issued, you had not been consulted on.
Correct. Right?
And
correct.
You could not assist them with.
Yes, correct.
And then from paragraph 47 onwards of your affidavit, you talk about being visited by sub-office officials at your work. Can you investigating a leak of the report? Can you tell the committee about that?
Okay, thanks, Chair. So after I left the Public Protector's office, I was then contacted that there are subs officials, inverted commas, the Hawks, who were investigating a leak of a report in the Office of the Public Protector at the time, and that when the PP laid a complaint or opened a case at Hatfield Police Station, she mentioned my name, and that's why the police wanted to get my side of the story. Then I obviously confirmed that I sent out the report to all the parties and that I had nothing to do with the leak or the leaking of the preliminary report. That was, I think, around March, if not April, of 2017, and this report was still in the media space. Thereafter, I received a set of questions from the National Prosecuting Authority asking questions about my involvement and how the report was sent out and all those things. I prepared an affidavit and submitted to them. I no longer have that affidavit with me, but I prepared an affidavit and submitted. That was the last time I heard from them during that particular time. And after that, later on, I was then visited somewhere end of April. The police then visited my place of residence. They wanted to search my house for documents. Unfortunately or fortunate, I didn't have anything anyway, but fortunately or unfortunately, they didn't have a search warrant. So I then said to them, if you don't have a search warrant, then you are not going to search my house. Then that was the end. The last time I heard from them in that regard. Not that one had anything to hide, by the way, but it was just an issue of saying, I just can't have police officers coming to my house and say, we want to search your house. That was the end or the last time I heard from the police officers.
So Mr. Tebogo Kekana gave evidence a week or so ago, and his evidence was to the effect at paragraph 15 of his affidavit. He said that on the 21st of December, the the provisional report was leaked and made publicly available. Do you know anything about that?
Nope.
Right. He, of course, continues in that paragraph, and he says that the provisional report had never been quality assured prior to it being leaked, opposed to it being released. You know, now you say you know nothing about a leak,
yeah.
But let's talk about it being quality assured or not before it was released. What do you have to say about that?
Yeah, I don't know what he meant by that, because the report was already with the power protector. So I've already explained to the committee that the procedure is there will be documents or reports that will go to the power protector without going through that process, which I have noted that when it was happening, this report was with the PP. At no point, at no stage did the PP say to me, refer this particular report to a quality assurance team. She signed the report after having considered it, as I've indicated. To the best of my knowledge, I would not want to comment much on what he meant on that, because prior to this, he was not involved at any stage with the investigation.
Thank you, Advocate Chiwalule. Advocate Mayotse will pause there and take tea for 15 minutes back at 22. Thank you.
Recording stopped.
Time now is 11:40. We resume with our work, leading evidence. I hand over to Advocate Mayosi.
Thank you, Chair. Advocate Chiwalula, we were traversing the affidavit of Mr. Kekana. And I think you were explaining to the committee his assertion that the report had never been quality assured prior to it being released. Yes?
Yes. Thanks, Chair. Yes, I was explaining that the report was already at the level of the power protector. She had already looked at it. Obviously, she had wanted more time to go through some of the things that she wanted to go through. These include the documents that I had submitted to her, the boxes, two boxes with the evidence. There was never an instruction to me by the power protector that I should refer the report to the quality assurance team. And whatever changes that I've made in the report, those changes were made under the instruction of the power protector. Either when we were working on the draft report that Advocate Matonze had worked on, and at the time when we were finalizing the provisional report that Advocate Kwebana had issued, everything that was done there was done under the instruction of the PP.
And then you see, Mr. Kekana there says he then was of the view that the report that was released, it contained numerous errors and was missing vital information. And he told the PP about this. Do you have anything to say about that, the errors and the vital information missing?
No, I can't comment on that. I think without any specific, you know, indication of the areas that he's talking about, I really have no comment on that.
All right. Go back to his affidavit. Number 49. Yeah, thank you. So you had explained to the committee how SAPS visited your workplace and your home investigating a leak of the report and so on. Were you requested at any point, because we now know, because we're sitting here, that there was litigation that ensued as a result of the report, the final report in June. Were you requested at any stage to assist in the compilation of the Rule 53 record?
No.
And can you tell the committee of any involvement, if any, you had in the Frede Dairy report?
Okay. The Frede Dairy investigation was being done by the province of Free State. At some point in 2016, the Section 7-9, if not a provisional report, was then submitted to the think tank that said at that particular time, under Advocate Matonzela at the time. The former PP was not satisfied with the work that was done on that particular investigation. I vividly recall her informing the Free State team that they needed to go back and do some work on that particular investigation. This included interviews, people that were not interviewed, which she felt that they needed to be interviewed. They also include politicians who were not interviewed at that particular time. It also included an issue that she raised about the office conducting what she would term a desktop investigation, in the sense that the investigators had not yet gone to the site where this particular farm or Fred Dairy is. So those were some of the gaps that I still remember that she raised at that think tank. The think tank then took a decision that the report must be referred back to the province, or the Section 7-9 that had been drafted at that particular time was not ready for release, must be referred back to the province for the province to then finalize that. She was not happy at all, because her view was she had wanted this to be released before she leave the office. It didn't happen, obviously, because of a number of things that were happening at that particular time. with the investigation. Some of them obviously do take some longer than others. So that's what transpired, which I can recall in as far as this is concerned.
Just a pause there, Advocate Mayosi. I'm told that live stream is not back after break. Can we check that? You are leaving people behind. Honorable Hendricks, can you hear us? Honorable Hanif Hendricks, can you hear us? Aid Hassan.
Yes, I can hear you, Honorable Chair, loud and clear.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Honorable Hendricks. Just a pause, want to make sure the live stream is with us. Are we winning, IT? Okay, there's an indication that they are back. They are back on. Thank you. Apologies. Please proceed, Advocate Mayosi.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I do not have further questions for this witness, but I would like to point out just for hygiene purposes, I guess, that in line with Honourable Heron's suggestion about the parties discussing issues that are not in dispute beforehand and possibly curtailing the time spent on witnesses, the PP's team indicated that in relation to this witness and his affidavit, they are in agreement with paragraphs 1 to 27 of his affidavit, paragraphs 31 to 33, paragraphs 42 to 43. Although they may ask questions, they say, they reserve the right to ask whatever clarification questions may arise from his testimony. And then, of course, the rest of the paragraphs they will interact with. I thought I should just point that out. I have no further questions for the witness.
Okay. Thank you, Advocate Mayosi. The time is 11:51. I now recognize Advocate Mbofu.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, can I just also start with a few housekeeping issues before I come to the witness, with your permission?
Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, the three or four issues which I just want to raise quickly, two of them don't pertain to this witness. The other two pertain to him. So let me start with the broader issues. The first one is, Chair, just for the record and for the attention of the members, to bring it to your attention or to their attention and also to the attention of the public, because we've been getting inquiries, but we thought before we could respond to those inquiries, out of respect, we should raise this matter here in the formal hearing. And that is the matter, Chair. By now you would have received a letter from us from the 8th, that is the day before the public holiday, pertaining to the request that we're making to you to take the necessary steps to subpoena or summon President Cyril Ramaphosa, given the report that we last gave that he had declined the invitation to appear voluntarily. That letter, I'm sure, has either reached you now, Chair, or it will reach you if it's still in the pipeline. And there have been inquiries about it, but we didn't want to release it to the public domain before we place it on record here. The second issue, Chair, is there's another letter which is coming your way. I'm not sure if it has already been sent. If it's not, it will be with you in the next couple of hours. And that's a separate matter regarding the recall of the witnesses that still had outstanding cross-examination, which we did not finish. And that would be witness Mr. Van Lochrenbeck and Mr. Pillay. That is, as I say, you'll receive it today if you haven't yet received it, if your secretariat has not. Then, Chair, if you can come then to the issues of today. Firstly, yes, to confirm the summary of the areas that we have indicated to the evidence leaders in respect of the suggestion of Honourable Heron, we sought to curtail the time spent on the witness by indicating those areas in respect of which we are in agreement. Obviously, subject to the reservation of our rights, should he say anything in oral argument that we might want to dispute. And there isn't really much. There's one or two issues that we will raise with the witness. Then finally, Chair, it's a request. I don't know how much time we were going to request that we also be given the half an hour that the evidence leaders had to put the matter of CX in perspective. But, and we can exercise that either by doing it upfront or doing it via the witness. I'm not quite, I don't mind whichever way is preferable, if in principle, if you agree for us to do so. And the reason, Chair, is that we have noticed that the evidence leaders, I mean, they've done this traversal of the cases before Mr. Kekana at the beginning of the matter, I think on the 11th of July, and now again today. And the result of that is that it's almost like legal argument or giving the narrative of the perspective of what the issues are, which is fine, but we should also be able to articulate, so to speak, what the counter narrative is in this, particularly in respect of section, the judgments. I'm just placing that again on the record, Chair. I'm neutral as to whether we do it via the witness or we do it up front. Oh, if you want to give us guidance, you may, but it's just a question of
yes.
Thank you, Chair.
Yes, no, thank you, Advocate Mpofu. The other issues you have raised, especially the first two, I take note of those. We'll Thanks. Wait for both letters, and we'll give you feedback on both those issues. On the last point, because I would have given the evidence leaders between when we started up until lunchtime, and I indicated to them that they don't need to go to lunchtime, so they did not. They've just finished now, and the plan was to have you say from immediately after lunch to 5. So we'll now take you the latest, if you have to, up to 4, kind of. Again, as I said to them, you don't have to go to 4. It's up to you. But on the issue of raising, it really has to be your comfort. If you think that you want to start with those issues, please do so. If you want to do them as you cross-examine the witness, I think also that should not be a train smash.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you very much, Chair. I appreciate that. Then I think what I should do, Chairperson, is to I'll do a bit of both. So I'll just outline one or two issues, but some of them I'll lead through the witness, if I may, Chair.
Proceed. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Thank you, Chairperson and honorable members. I just want, firstly, to confirm what Advocate Bauer said, namely that this witness is principally really about the matter of CX. And maybe let me just put, because I think as we go forward, we need to try and focus the inquiry into the issues, because we started, you know, on a wide angle. And I think as we're going along with the particular witnesses, we're now focusing on particular areas. So how we view the landscape is that the motion or the issues that are before you, either from the motion or from the independent panel report, can be condensed into principally four charges, broad charges, as we said on day one, which some of them have sub-charges. But also there are four principal reports or rather judgments which characterize the motion. One of them is CX, which is what we're dealing with now, and I will come back to the specific issues that I want to raise at a broad level around CX. The second one is Frieder, And we've touched on Friday, both with the witnesses, Samuel and Kekana, to some extent. And then there was a summary of the judgments which was done. So the issues have been outlined there. The third important judgment is the judgment that we call CR-17/BUSASA. That is, we have not yet really gone into that particular judgment or that series of judgments. And it also has to do with the subpoena to President Ramaphosa that I mentioned earlier, which I've addressed the committee on previously. So I also don't want to dwell much into that. Simply to flag that we will hopefully deal with that stream or that third leg in the same way, via witnesses and also summaries of the judgment and so on and so on. Then there's the judgment of the Financial Service Board Conduct Committee, or something like that, which again also has not been dealt with. And then there are other judgments, let's call them that, and that includes the Pillay, Godan, stroke, rogue unit, stream of judgments, which we have dealt with via the witnesses, Van Lochenberg and Pillay so far. Some of those witnesses are going to come back and we will deal with them and finalize that stream. Again, you have been given the judgment summaries and obviously we will call evidence in respect of that. So that's the broad landscape. And the format seems to be that we go through the judgments, analyze them, and then have witnesses on both sides, you know, promoting whatever the narrative and counter-narrative, so to speak, or the issues that we want to highlight, that both the evidence leaders and ourselves might want to highlight. Maybe to call it narrative and counter-narrative might be to overstate the issue. Right. Now, against that background, that then covers the entire, of course, there's the issue, the so-called HR issues, the alleged harassment, victimization, and intimidation of witnesses, which is a unique type of issue that doesn't really depend on the judgments. So we can flag that as a separate issue. But then that covers the entire motion, so to speak, whether on the wide angle that is preferred by the committee or the narrower angle that is preferred by us, which is based on the independent panel report. Now, coming back then to this leg of the inquiry, which we are busy with now, which is the CX matter. It's important for me just to focus the attention of the committee on what, at least from our point of view, we regard to be the main issues around that report. The first one is the allegation which is contained and summarized in the report as well, broadly speaking, that the public protector widened the scope of the investigation, and a whole lot of things fall under that, and I'll deal with them, some of them, with this witness now, and but I just want to flag it as a heading or a topic here. The second one, which is also isolated properly by the independent panel, is that the remedial action that the public protector issued differs substantially from that which Advocate Matonsela issued. Again, there are many sub-issues that fall under that. The third, which is quite important, is this issue of the judgments. And that's really what I wanted to put in perspective. Because that some of it might come via the witness, some of it not. You will recall, for example, that we canvassed some of the issues in the judgments with witness Kekana, and I think to some extent with witness Samuel. And there are two types of issues that we want to flag in respect of the judgments. According to the independent panel, the focus is on the constitutional court judgment, and that makes sense because the other judgments were just building up towards that judgment, and that's the one that is allegedly binding and all that. I don't want to enter that debate again for now for present purposes. But what we want to flag out, and which will also assist in focusing our questioning and hopefully the questioning of the members, is the following. And it's a bit of a concern for us because when these judgments are being summarized, quote unquote, by the evidence leaders, for the second time now, if not the third time, there is a focus only on the majority judgment of the Constitutional Court. And we want to disabuse the process of that notion. Of course, a majority judgment is a majority judgment, and lawyers know what the implications thereof are. But against the background of what this exercise is supposed to be about, this entire inquiry, which is effectively to revisit some of those issues. Otherwise, as we have said many times, there would be no point in having this inquiry. We could simply all just read the judgments and then pass our verdict, so to speak. In our view, the purpose of having this process is exactly to relook into those issues because of the warning that was given by the independent panel report, which is that those judgments would have been given in a different context of review proceedings as opposed to the current, shall we call it, disciplinary process for misconduct and or incompetence. Now, the importance of the fact that particularly as far as the CX matter is concerned, there was quite a strong dissenting judgment which was issued by Judge Justice Mukhweng CJ and Justice Goliath. And one might say an equally strong majority judgment issued by Hampempe J and Teron J. And we simply want to, at this early stage, to highlight that at the end, when we are arguing the matter and both in writing and otherwise summarizing, our approach is going to be that the judgment and particular aspects of the judgments of the minority should be preferred for various reasons, which we will converse with the witnesses and also in argument. And again, I don't want to go into the legalities of the issue. Some will say, no, you must ignore the minority judgment. Others might say, as if this was a court, no, it's only the majority judgment that should be looked at. We'll have all those niceties and all those arguments at the right time. We know that the evidence leaders hold the view that the judgments should just be or binding, quote unquote, whatever that means in the context of an inquiry. And we have expressed our view as to that question, both at the beginning and in the cross-examination of Mr. Pillay, for example. So I'm not entering that terrain. I'm simply highlighting the fact that there are those judgments, and the second judgment in particular, the minority judgment, held quite sharply different views as in respect of the conclusions that were reached by the majority on issue, on the key issues, namely whether there was bad faith, for example, or whether it's important the fact that there was a meeting with the presidency, is it something of significance or not, or of no significance? And Chair, if you allow me, then the last thing I'm going to do, I promise, in respect of that, of putting that perspective, is just to illustrate the point, I will read out some of the passages in the Mokgweng CJ judgment in CX, because that will also feature in my questioning. May I do that, Chair?
Yes, proceed, but you're just going low on your volume.
Let me do the magic trick. How is that now, Chair?
Okay, that's fine. Go ahead.
That better. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much, Chairperson. Right. Now, the judgments, for anyone else who might be listening, the Constitutional Court judgment is reported in as Public Protector versus South African Reserve Bank, 2019, Volume 6, SA 253, the judgment of the Constitutional Court. There are, as I've already mentioned, two separate judgments. The one that I'm going to be dealing with now, well, the evidence leaders have dealt with the majority judgment, and the one that I'm going to talk about is the minority judgment of Mokgweng CJ and Goliath AJ. And I'd like, again, for members of the committee, when they read this, it's not a very long judgment, so I'm sure, that's a relative thing for lawyers and non-lawyers. But the passages that I would recommend for anyone who doesn't want to read the whole thing in respect of the minority judgment would be from round about paragraph 56, which deals with gross negligence and bad faith in the context that I've already mentioned. And then from bad faith is paragraph 71 up to 89. So effectively, the core of the minority judgment is paragraphs 56 to 89. I won't read all of them, but I'm going to read substantial portions thereof. Right. And the background to this is the basis upon which the Constitutional Court would have found that there was bad faith and gross negligence and so on, which then leads to the motion that the public protector must be impeached for those reasons. Right. I'll start at paragraph 57, where the Chief Justice said the following. The Reserve Bank says that it would have explained why the proposed constitutional amendment should not have formed part of the remedial action and why an investigation by the Special Investigating Unit should not be ordered. So the contention is that there was no disclosure of meetings when this was reasonably expected to be done, and there was no further consultation with the banks before the final remedial action was taken. This, the Reserve Bank says, denied it the opportunity to make representations that could possibly have averted a remedial action that could lead to an investigation by the SIU and the constitutional amendment by Parliament. Remember, the then public protector, Ms. Tulisile Madonsela, had already expressed a preference for an investigation in her provisional report, namely a judicial commission of inquiry. And her successor, Ms. Busisiwe Mkhwebane, says that after her meeting with the presidency, incorrectly referred to as having been part of what occurred on 25 April 2017 in an answering affidavit, she realized that the commission route might be problematic since its legality was already a subject of a matter of litigation in relation to another public protector's report, hence has switched to the SIU approach. Just to pause there, the other report referred to, everyone will know, is about the state capture report that the witness mentioned. There was litigation at that stage as to whether it was competent for the public protector to issue remedial action, which calls for a commission of inquiry. So that was the reason why she was exploring the alternatives. Next paragraph. Besides, something needs to be put into proper perspective here. In her answering affidavit, the public protector alludes to what is in effect the meeting of 7 June 2017, or both April 2017 and June 2017, as the meeting of 25 April 2017. All things put together, part of what she attributes to the meeting of April actually relates to that of 7 June, as her notes of the latter meeting show. What matters is the content of the discussions and the acknowledgement that the meeting had a role to play in the final determination of the remedial action taken. It cannot therefore be a consequence of a correct and fair assessment of the public protector's version to conclude that she only disclosed the meeting of April 2017, but concealed or was totally secretive about the fact of the one of June 2017 taking place. Doing so could reasonably be misunderstood as being symptomatic of a desperation to find fault. Now, let me pause there again. What the judges were saying is that I think Advocate Bauer mentioned this so-called secretive meeting in this morning when she was summarizing. Was that it didn't make sense why it would be of any significance, and it was referred to as a desperation to find fault. Then the next paragraph says, so what was gross about her negligence, extremely appropriate, clearly or indubitably vexatious or reprehensible by the conduct in relation to A, her interactions with the presidency and the state security agency, two, her treatment of the transcript of minutes, and three, not affording the banks the opportunity to be heard for the second time after the provisional report was released to interested parties. What harm, actual or potential, was to flow from the public protector's conduct that would explain the, quote, grossness of the negligent conduct? Put differently, whether the reference to the SIU investigation, reprehensible as the public protector's conduct might be or is, what damage did she occasion or could she cause by ordering a different kind of investigation from the one already proposed in the provisional report of Advocate Madonsen? That's my addition. Then the learned judge, Chief Justice, then says, if it was in law wrong or negligent of Ms. Mkobana to have changed from an investigation by a judicial commission of inquiry proposed by Ms. Madonsela to an investigation by a specialized prosecution unit, then negligence cannot be gross for that reason alone. For it would be no more than a change of the vehicle for doing that exact same thing based on a wrong understanding of the law. And that extends to her understanding that because the Reserve Bank was not being asked to initiate any process, no remedial action was being taken against it, and it was therefore not necessary for it to be consulted. The reality is that although the Reserve Bank has a material interest in the lifeboat-related process, since its fingerprints are all over it, when it was directed by the public protector to offer its inevitable cooperation in the investigation, it was not required to act unless others, the president and the SIU, did. It ought therefore to be understandable how an error, if it be, could be made by any reasonable person on the basis that, since they had been consulted after the provisional report, a second consultation in relation to the same report was not necessary. I'm about to finish this section, Chair. Then it goes on to say, after provisional report was issued and after consulting with the Reserve Bank, the public protector consulted with the presidency at the latter's request. This, the Reserve Bank says, she should not have done, since the presidency had nothing to do with her key recommendations or remedial steps, particularly the possible constitutional amendment as it relates to or impacts on economic issues. The Reserve Bank contends that it should have been consulted about economic issues and Parliament consulted about the constitutional amendment instead, but this is an erroneous contention. First, The President of the Republic has a critical role to play in the affairs of this country, including the attainment of safeguarding of good governance or the recreation of corruption-free and truly law-governed environment, especially as regards constitutional institutions. The Reserve Bank must be trusted to, quote, perform its functions independently and without fear, favor, or prejudice. There must therefore be no reason to believe that this constitutionally ordained facilitator of, quote, balanced and sustainable economic growth in the Republic is favorably disposed to some players in the economy in disregard of its mandate, or that it could even as much as consider entering into an unlawful contract at a great financial loss to and to the prejudice of the interests of the general public. Allegations of corruption, illegality, or impropriety, especially those relating to an amount in excess of 1 billion rand, appear to be sufficiently serious to warrant credible closure via the medium of a thorough investigation, however old the subject matter of investigation might be. And on this, both Ms. Madonsela and Ms. Mkhwebane fundamentally agree. I'll jump the next paragraph. The 64, the public protector got the law completely wrong by acting as if it was open to her to direct parliament to amend the constitution, and even in a specific way. She, like any other citizen, could of course suggest, but most certainly could not take remedial action to that effect. How then is the gravity of the negligent conduct to be gauged in this connection? Is it with reference to the radical departure from the norm, the failure to appreciate the vital limits of her constitutional powers, or with special regard to the deleterious effect of the proposed amendment? Is the determination of the seriousness of gross nature of negligence relating to the amendment not context specific? Then the Chief Justice goes on to say that it is so context specific. I'll start the next one from the second sentence. Therefore, any endeavor to that end may rightly be criticized and dismissed as bereft of seriousness given the nature of intricacies of lawmaking or constitutional amendment and Parliament's functional independence. The public protector's remedial action was a known or predictable non-starter in legal sectors. The Reserve Bank had access to the best of lawyers who could, as urgently as was considered necessary, have come there unnecessarily and unreasonably aroused nerves or jitters and those of the markets, that there really was nothing to worry about. Sentiments and sensationalism aside, an objective, reasoned, and calm approach by the public protector, ill-advised or overzealous proposal must inevitably lead to the conclusion that it was inconsequential, never posed any real but only an imaginary threat to the well-being of the Reserve Bank and all other interests, and including reasonably informed economic forces or markets. Remedial action was bound to be set aside with ease. Unsurprisingly, this is important, the public protector did not even oppose its setting aside of that portion. Then there's a discussion on the issue of the vulnerability. As for the meeting, I'm jumping to 67. As for the meeting with the State Security Agency and discussing the Reserve Bank's vulnerability, it must not be forgotten that it was the State Security Agency that virtually initiated the investigation. That's a point I made to Mr. Kekana. To recover whatever the Reserve Bank had given away illegally, that culminated in the CX report. A meeting with them was most appropriate, and we must be loath readily to infer cynicism from that meeting. Once being held, anything including the bank's vulnerability could legitimately be discussed. It is astounding that, knowing this, the High Court still went on to conclude that, quote, head discussion pertaining to the Reserve Bank cannot be justified in any manner. It is a factual misdirection. And so is the finding that she was overly secretive about their meeting. How can a secretive person go so far as to waive the classification of the record of her discussion with the same State Security Agency of her own volition? Besides, the discussion of the Reserve Bank's vulnerability is not one of the reasons relied on by the High Court to make the unprecedented order that it made. It thus ill behoves any court to augment the deficient reasoning of the High Court with the vulnerability issue. Then it goes on about the transcript of the minutes, and that's Mr. Kekana's minutes that we've already spoken about. Then the last paragraph 69 says, it bears emphasis that she was under no legal obligation to record and transcribe her meetings with the president, the state security agency, or even the banks. And it is inappropriate to use her departure from her own practice and her failure to explain it as one of the grounds for awarding exceptionally high personal costs against her. For it does appear that a lot is being deduced from the record and conduct of the public protector that is not borne out by the facts and the law. But yes, what cannot be denied is that in her somewhat incongruous handling of some of the issues relating to the investigation and reporting, the public protector ultimately disclosed all that is foundational to the possibly alleged grossness of her negligence and her non-disclosure relied on by the Reserve Bank. Apart from the High Court's failure to rely on gross negligence and explain how it was proven, the facts do not bear it out. Then the next section is the one that deals with bad faith, Chair. I'm not going to read it. I'll just pick out one or two issues. Yes, let's start at 72. The correct approach to determining the existence of bad faith is therefore one that recognizes that bad faith exists only when the office bearer acted with specific intent to deceive, harm, or prejudice another person, or by proof of serious or gross recklessness that reveals a breakdown of the orderly exercise of authority so fundamental that absence of good faith can be reasonably inferred from bad faith presumed. This is so because the mischief sought to be rooted out by rendering bad faith so severely punishable, particularly within the public sector space, is to curb abuse of office, which invariably has prejudicial consequences for others. Abuse of office undermines the efficacy of state machinery and denies justice and fairness to all people and instructions. For a person who acts in bad faith is one who hopes to get away with a surreptitious connivance to harm the unsuspecting other. Within the context of this case, the High Court would have had to be satisfied that the public protector sought to disadvantage the Reserve Bank, acting in cahoots with the presidency or whoever else. Not only would the prejudice have to be explained by the High Court, but the conspiracy or connivance insinuated would have to be classified by the public protector for the devious scheme to succeed. Neither the president nor the state security agencies are competitors with the litigants bank, nor did they initiate the investigation of the public protector that culminated in the final remedial action. It is Mr. Hoffman who did. That's the complainant. The question of favoritism or partiality does not therefore arise. Much more would have had to be said by the High Court in support of the alleged partiality or lack of good faith of the public protector, especially because the prominent role these factors played in awarding the personal and punitive costs. Yes. Then I'll jump to 76. Turning to a somewhat different subject, the president would have a role to play in the reopening of the investigation into the lifeboat saga by the SIU. Partiality or bad faith cannot therefore flow or be reasonably inferred from the fact that the president was consulted about this matter. The presidency has a material interest in matters concerning the possible disregard for the law or impropriety of a very important constitutional institution like the Reserve Bank, and deserved to be consulted. Nothing sinister or anything that smacks of lack of impartiality or independence or to flow so effortlessly from the meeting. And the Dr. Tsefo Makoka issue calls for attention as it relates to or seems to undergird the thinly articulated bad faith requirement. Just to save time, Chair, I'll summarize what is stated from paragraph 78 to... ...81. Effectively, what is said there is that the public protector, one of the reasons why she was criticized for having to pay for dishonesty, bad faith, and all sorts of things, was because she said she had consulted with economists, with economic experts in plural. And it was agreed by everyone that Dr. Goodson, you might remember him being referred to in Mr. Kekana's evidence, was an economist. But it was wrongly assumed, we will show this when we give our evidence, that the reference, the plural reference, was to a Dr. Mukoka, who was, it was common cause, only consulted after the investigation. But the public protector has explained that the other economic expert in that context was the Dr. Moodley, who happened to have worked at the Reserve Bank, but also working at the security state security agents. So that's what's discussed in the paragraphs that I'm jumping. And then I go to paragraph 82, which is what those judges then concluded around that issue. They say a deceitful or dishonest functionary would not herself have exposed, quote, her lie, or allowed anybody acting on her behalf to do so, especially to those she knew would or clearly determined to use it against her. This explains why the minister did not disclose anything about the work streams. A common sensical approach to real life issues militates against the adverse inference or conclusion sought to be drawn or reached. This is not a case of being caught or found out. The public protector laid it bare herself. A dishonest conspirator, as the public protector is made out to be, would in all probability have shredded or concealed the documentation. Not even a Rule 53 application has the necessary force to compel a fraudster to discover what she is intent on concealing in order to deceive successfully. Interestingly, for her to know which documents to disclose, logic dictates that she would have had to read her handwritten notes that expose the plot, unquote, or deception by revealing information about the 7th June 2017 meeting. The notion that she was being partial or acted in bad faith and that it is only reasonable inference to be drawn from her failure to disclose this information and not consult with the banks lacks substance. And it must be emphasized that the conclusion that she was dishonest or deceitful is belied by her declassification of notes of her meeting with the state security agency, her somewhat belated disclosure of all the other information, including the dates of the meetings, her contemporaneous notes of what was discussed and the effect of the meeting with the presidency on the choice of the vehicle of the investigation. I jump to 86. In sum, the basis for the presumably alleged partial or bad faith are just too thin and unexplained. Considerations of justice demand much more to conclude that these have been demonstrated. Besides, there is much to be said for the public protector's contention that just as partiality or apprehension of bias in relation to judicial officers is not highly inferred, so should it be with the public protector. That stems from the presumption of impartiality in their favor, which has more to do with the weight of the constitutional obligation imposed on them to act without fear, favor, or prejudice. The presumption applies subject to appropriate adjustments to the public protector, who is similarly required to act in terms of that constitutional injunction. No wonder even that a high court judge may be appointed to the position of public protector. Yes, I think I'll stop there, Chair, and invite members to read some of those comments for themselves. But that is the perspective that we have been finding to be missing in the multiple summary of the judgments by the evidence leaders. And I'm sure it was not, maybe it was based, honestly based on the notion that the minority judgment does not count, but it does, because that's exactly what we're going to be arguing in the end, that the analysis that was the very lucid analysis of the Chief Justice is what should be preferred. We have already demonstrated, for example, on the vulnerability issue that the public protector was being unfairly targeted for something that Mr. Kekana has suggested was his own notes to himself. And we've also demonstrated the issue of the so-called economists. And we will continue doing those. And we intend to do that also via this witness, Chairperson, with your permission. Can I therefore then start with the witness?
Yes, just before you do that, I recognize Advocate Bauer.
Can I just make one correction? I was not dealing with the majority judgment of the Constitutional Court this morning, ignoring the minority. I had said quite clearly I was only dealing with the full bench, and I would come to the Constitutional Court judgments again.
All right. Okay. Well, thank you for pointing that out. Advocate Mbofu, you may proceed.
Thank you, Chairperson. Well, I just want, just in quick response to that, to say that Advocate Bauer did refer to the judgment, and I think even the issues about the secretive nature and the findings on bad faith and so on, but that's fine. I don't want to quibble about that. She did say that she was going to start with the Murphy judgment and take it right up to the Concord judgment. But in any event, whether she did or not, the independent panel correctly pointed out that the focus should be on the Constitutional Court judgment. Thank you, Chairperson. Good afternoon, Advocate Chualule.
Good afternoon, Advocate Mbofu.
How are you this afternoon?
I'm doing very well. How are you?
I'm very well. Thank you. Thank you very much. Yes, you know, as we indicated, there are large sections of your affidavit which we don't take issue with. So the cross-examination is really mainly for clarificatory purpose. It will be relatively painless. And that's because your as we understand it, really your role here is unlike those other witnesses who have an axe to grind or are disgruntled and all that. You are just here to assist the process, correct?
Correct.
Yes. And yours is just to give perspective, and we assume that the evidence leaders wanted for you to give the historical perspective, particularly on the CX matter, correct?
Correct.
Right. And I just want to confirm that just for perspective and context, I mean, you are an advocate, you know the importance of context, correct?
Correct.
Right. And here, first of all, we're dealing with a report for events, or rather the investigation started around about 2011, to your knowledge. You may not have been involved with it, but about 2011, correct?
Correct.
Right. And I'm sure you would agree that it took much longer than it should have, this investigation, correct?
Correct.
Mr. Chalule?
He said correct. Maybe yeah, you missed
oh,
that.
Oh, sorry. I missed that. There's something that means there was something wrong on our side. Thank you very much. Thank you for that. Surely an investigation should not take almost the full term of a public protector. From 2011 up to 2016 would be about 6 years, correct?
Correct.
Yeah. And be that as it may, it is also so that I'm just jumping towards the other extreme now, towards the end. You have correctly pointed out that Advocate Matonsela was quite determined. It was one of the reports that she would have wished to issue before her term expired, correct?
Correct.
But as these things happen, that last rush that you and her participated in did not result in the issuance, in the finalization of the report, correct?
Correct.
And that, just to digress a little bit, there were, let's say, three, at least to my knowledge, and you might correct me if I'm wrong, three big investigations which she had hoped to finalize before she leaves, but somehow failed to do so. One of them was the CX report, as we've just confirmed. The other one was the Frieda report. And then, of course, the well-known state capture report, correct?
Correct. There were also others. I think just to add on that, there were a number of them. I think there were more than 10 reports that she had wanted to release. I do recall the investigation regarding, I think, the Free State website. Mm-hmm. There was also an investigation about Mandela funeral. She mm-hmm. wanted that finalized as well. There mm-hmm. was also an investigation regarding the funds that were that disappeared in the, I think, Bapoma Mohale in Northwest. So
Northwest,
a lot of work had been done on that, but obviously there were things that she felt that they still needed to be closed off or finalized before those reports could go out or the Section 79 notices could go out.
Yes, fair enough. So what I call these three big reports were, you are simply saying that they were part of a bigger pool of reports that she would have, all things being equal, she would have wanted to finalize before her departure, correct?
Correct.
Right. Now, one of the disturbing features about coming back now to the CX report is the fact that you remember there's one of the things that Advocate Mkweban is criticized for is her alleged failure to adhere to the 5-day promise which was made to the Reserve Bank that they would be given prior notice of the final report, something like that. You remember that?
You're referring to the 10 days, I think it's 10 days, in a meeting that I was not part of. I do recall that advocate, a counsel for, I think, Reserve Bank wrote to the PP inquiring about that, there was a promise that they would be given a report and they would be given 10 days within which they will then comment on the provisional report before it was released. That's all I can remember, and as far as that is concerned.
Yes, actually, it was both a 10-day and a 5-day promise alleged. 10 days, I think you're right, before it would be all right, I'll find it now, but okay, putting aside the number of days, the point that I was really driving to is on their version, that promise had been made in 2013, correct?
Correct.
September 2013, to be exact. Yeah.
Correct.
Yes. And there was even a letter which they say they wrote, I think in September 2013, which had not been answered by 2016.
Yes. Maybe to provide context to that, Advocate Mpofu, through you, Chair. Yes. That letter relates, my memory serves me well, it related to an argument that was being raised by Reserve Bank and I think the Minister of Finance, if I'm not mistaken, or APSA, where their argument was that this investigation relates to issues that predate the establishment of the Office of the Power Protector, and that we should actually not touch it. When I joined the investigation, these issues were brought to my attention as well, that the reason the investigation has stalled so much was because there was this to and fro and arguments that have been raised by the parties involved that, well, why are you investigating this issue? It's a deadwood. It's an issue that happened even before your office was established. But I remember advancing an argument that says the issue here is not about the things that happened prior to the establishment of the Office of the Power Protector, but rather the issues are about what the government did when the government entered into the agreement with CX. That was done after the establishment of the Office of Power Protection. So we are only mainly focusing on that, and we are not focusing on what transpired between 85 and 1992, to be precise.
Yes. No, fair enough. Yes. But nevertheless, thank you for that background. If you go to page 3291, that is a letter from the Reserve Bank to the Public Protector, quite a long letter. You remember that letter?
You said 3291.
Yes, Chairperson.
Okay, thank you. We'll flight it if you don't have it there.
Yeah. No problem.
The letter actually starts at 3285. Maybe we should just run it from there. Just, it's quite a comprehensive letter, just to show that. Yes. Okay. It's a letter from the Reserve Bank to Advocate Mkwebane. Can you just run it? Just run it until you get to 3291. I just want to demonstrate that it's quite a longish letter and detailed. you remember this letter, Advocate?
Yes, I do.
Yes. In your statement, it is, I think it's just a mistake. You refer to that letter as coming from Mr. Chris van der Walt, but in fact, it came from Advocate De Jager, correct? Or a doctor, Dr. De Jager.
Can you please go down to the last page so that at least I can confirm that?
Yes, that will be a 3294, yes.
Yes, yes, you're quite correct.
Yes, and if you go to 3145, which is your statement, sorry. Yes, you'll see that you say on 25 November 2016, we received correspondence from Mr. Chris van der Walt of the SARB. I'm just saying that unless if I'm missing something, from my recollection, this letter was 25 October 2016, and also it came from Dr. De Jager, not Mr. van der Walt. That's not important. I'm just simply saying, just making sure that we're dealing with the same letter. Am I right?
Correct.
Thank you. Okay. All right. So subject to those minor corrections, for the record, Chair, the letter, therefore, was actually 25 October 2016 and came from Mr. Yacher. So the necessary changes would have to be made to paragraph 22 of the witness statement. But as I say, nothing much turns onto that. All right. Now we can then go to paragraph 3291, which is where I was leading to. Right. Just to confirm that around there where they talk about Ms. Marcus and Mr. Mboweni, just keep rolling a little bit. Yeah. It is to confirm what you were saying, Advocate, that this there was this discussion about prescription, rather jurisdiction, I think is a better word. Namely, yes. whether the, in terms of Section 6(9) of the Public Protector Act, whether the public protector would have been entitled to investigate something that was older than 2 years in terms of its occurrence. That's what you are referring right. to. Yes.
Yeah, correct.
Yeah, okay, we'll come back to that. What I want to discuss for now is if you go to 3.12. Yes. That this is the complaint that the public, rather the Reserve Bank was raising in the letter, that they had written this letter in 2013, and they say there was no response to this letter from the public protector for about 3 years. You remember that?
Yes, I do.
Yes, and it is in that context where I was saying that this particular report really should have been finalized earlier, and I think you have agreed with me on that, correct?
Yes, I do agree with you, and for the reasons that I've provided, which I was told why there was that delay. I want to make sure that I stress those. Yeah.
Yes, and it was before your time anyway.
Yes, it was before my time anyway, but I had to inquire why this had taken so long, obviously. As you have indicated, it was unusual for an investigation to take this long, and I've highlighted why it did as the reasons were provided to me.
Yes, right. Okay, right. Now, this public protector, Advocate Mkwebane, and I'm just trying to find if your comment would be, or rather whether you'd agree with me, once again, dealt with this matter as a matter of priority, correct?
Yes.
Yes. And she dealt with it with the due efficiency that it required, in that, for example, according to your testimony, within a matter of weeks of her taking office, she was already asking you, and you were giving her the boxes and all that, the evidence that you've already given, correct?
Correct.
Yes. And the result of all that was that, in fact, I thought you were being slightly unfair on Advocate Mkwebane, and I don't think you intended to, when you said in November she had not yet read the boxes. This would have been understandable because she had just taken office. It was hardly a month after taking office, correct?
Are you referring to the paragraph of my affidavit where I mentioned the issue of me asking her whether she had already gone through the evidence yes. I had submitted?
I'm referring to that. Yes, I'm referring to that, and I think you also commented on it this morning. I'm simply saying that if you look at it in perspective, she acted with due efficiency, given the fact that this investigation was already 6 years old, that within 2 or 3 weeks, there had already been an exchange of the boxes between you and her and the downloading of the information.
Yeah.
And given the fact that it was not the only report that is outstanding, I'm not making a big thing out of it. I'm simply saying that she had acted with deliberate speed.
Yes, I would say so.
Thank
I would
you.
Agree with you.
Thank you very much. Now, the other issue is that you had again correctly pointed out that in your estimation, one of the reasons why you had been retained in the private office was for the sake of, shall we call it, continuity and institutional memory, correct?
Yes, correct. And I think I must qualify that, Advocate Mpofu. I didn't, obviously, in the beginning, because I saw things that were happening in the private office where other people, for example, chief of staff and other officials who were there working with Advocate Madonsela, including two of our PAs and also the secretary, when they were all told that they should now go and report elsewhere in the different units. When I was retained, I had a discussion with my colleagues, why am I still there? Why? Because I thought I was going to be taken out of that particular space by virtue of probably working with the previous PP. But obviously, I had an understanding that I was a professional. I didn't had any allegiance to Advocate Madonsela. You know, she didn't even know me when I was appointed there. So similarly, I would continue to work with the new PP. I had no issues even when I was there. Yeah, so that was the issue. So, but obviously, I was concerned that not only are officials who were working with me, all of them out of that space, and there are new people that I now have to work with. So that was just an issue that I noted as well.
Yes. No, fine. No, I don't think there's much to be said about that. Have you worked in government before?
Yes, I have.
Yes. Oh, so you, which department?
I worked at IDT, Independent Development Trust.
Oh, okay. Not in an actual department, in an agent. Yeah. No, I was going. But yeah, just knowing working in that space, you would know that, for example, this is for what is known as the private office of a minister. Normally, when there's a change of minister, those people either go with that minister or the new minister brings their own private staff. But in the DG's office, for example, there'd be permanent continuity. You are familiar with that?
Yes, I am.
Yes, thank you. All right. Now, given so you found alternative employment of your own volition, correct?
Correct.
You were not purged or anything like that. You just found another job.
Yeah, no, I was not purged. I found another job and I felt that I had already done my part. There were several engagements I had with Advocate Mukwevana because I sent her my letter of appointment and she congratulated me for that. And obviously she was concerned that I'll be leaving some way that I had not yet finalized. And following that, there were just engagements that are normal where people say we could try and counter your offer or whatever, but didn't get to anything that I can obviously say.
Okay. No, thank you very much. No, in fact, that is the evidence that African Kobano was going to give that, but thanks for confirming that far from paging you, she was actually trying to retain you if she could, but obviously your other offer, we won't ask you how good that other offer was, but it was...
they couldn't afford me. Let's put it that way.
Yes.
They couldn't afford me, so that's why I'm
okay. Yes, yeah. No, that's fine, yeah. Thank you. But of course, there was that qualified, although she congratulated you, she did point out, because obviously she was apprehensive about if you were just going to say, I'm leaving tomorrow. I'm not saying that's what you intended to do, but it was important for there to be that 30-day period so that you could then do a proper handover of the, particularly of the handover files, the files that were straddling between Advocate Madonsela's era and the new era, correct?
Correct.
Right. Okay, now then comes this issue.
Maybe Advocate Mpofu,
yes,
maybe
sir.
On that point, if we can ask you to pause.
Yes, sir.
We'll take a lunch break and be back at 2.
Thank you, sir. That's convenient. I was going to start a new topic.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. We pause. Break for
recording
lunch.
Recording stopped.